From Pacifica Radio, this is Democracy Now! Inaugural protesters charge that police security is chilling free speech. Today we will look at Education Secretary nominee Rod Paige. Why does the media love him? And an Israeli lawyer takes on the Israeli policy, the Israeli state policy of extrajudicial assassinations. We'll talk with the widow of one of the victims. All that and more coming up on Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! Welcome to Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. The Republican leader of the Senate yesterday served notice that he had all 50 Republican votes behind President-elect George W. Bush's choice for Attorney General John Ashcroft, and warned that Democratic efforts to derail the nomination could poison the effort to set a new cooperative tone on Capitol Hill. At the same time, conservative groups and a counteroffensive of internet organizations, news conferences, and phone banks vowed to redouble their effort to build grassroots pressure for Ashcroft's nomination. Several conservative women's groups planned a news conference in support today. Pat Robertson, president of the Christian Coalition, is to deliver a telephone message on behalf of Ashcroft to 500,000 supporters across the next few days. Bush advisors said the president-elect would fight vigorously for Ashcroft, in contrast to the situation with Linda Chavez, who did not give Bush or his aides an early warning that she had allowed an illegal immigrant to live with her in the early 1990s. We'll have more on Ashcroft later in the program. The Reverend Jesse Jackson, about 24 other demonstrators, were arrested last night outside a prison protesting the scheduled execution of Wanda Jean Allen, an African-American woman. Tracy Rice, Jackson's attorney, said the civil rights leader planned to stay in Oklahoma County Jail overnight. She said Jackson hoped to meet with corrections officials about witnessing the execution today by injection of Allen. A federal judge denied a 30-day stay of execution for Allen last night. Allen's lawyer said they plan to appeal the decision to the U.S. Supreme Court. Allen was convicted for the fatal shooting of her lover, Gloria Leathers, outside the Oklahoma City police station in 1988. A New York State judge declared the state's method of financing public schools illegal yesterday, saying it deprives New York City students of the sound basic education guaranteed by the state constitution. The judge handed the state legislature the delicate task of coming up with a new system by September 15th or facing judicial intervention. The judge found the school financing system also violated federal civil rights laws because it disproportionately hurt minority students. More than 70% of the state's Asian, Black, and Hispanic students live in New York City. New York is the latest of more than 24 states forced by courts to grapple with the job of assuring that poor students get an education that passes constitutional muster. This news from New Jersey: all the attention focused on racial profiling hasn't reduced the percentage of minorities stopped on the New Jersey Turnpike. According to data collected under terms of a federal consent decree, 40% of the motorists stopped by state troopers on the New Jersey Turnpike during the 6 months ending last October were Black or Latino. Statistics for the previous 4 months indicate 38% of those stopped were minorities. Black and Hispanic community leaders have charged that New Jersey state troopers overwhelmingly target minority drivers on the turnpike. President Clinton will not declare the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge in Alaska a national monument. Using the authority of the 1906 Antiquities Act, Clinton has created a dozen federal monuments this year by executive order. But the White House says Clinton won't do the same thing for the Alaska land because the officials claim it is already protected from development by law. The Arctic Refuge has an abundance of migrating birds, polar bears, musk oxen, grizzly bears, and other wildlife. It is also home to a herd of caribou, which comprises 80% of the diet of the Natsai Gurich tribe. President-elect Bush has advocated drilling in the reserve as a way to increase energy supplies. The United States and South Korea have concluded after 15 months of investigation that American soldiers killed, quote, an unknown number of refugees during the early days of the Korean War at Nogun Ri. President Clinton has refused to apologize and instead plans to express regret over South Korean civilian deaths at American hands in a statement later today after the results of the investigation are officially released in Washington and in Seoul. A joint statement of mutual understanding says the investigations found no proof of direct orders to fire on civilians, but the report cites military documents that U.S. troops in the war zone at the time were operating under what it calls guidelines on shooting refugees to prevent them from crossing U.S. front lines. And Philip Morris and other tobacco companies waged successful campaigns to undermine Swiss health measures, including smoke-free areas in restaurants and offices and cigarette advertising bans, according to a new study published today. The report says the tobacco industry exploited Swiss traditions of consensus democracy and enjoyed important support from politicians and other allies. It also said public health advocates underestimated the power of the industry and now need to do more to uncover its tactics.
To raise the question, worldwide coverage to launch investigations. This is about our liberation, deeper than one or two random acts of subjugation. Organize a nationwide demonstration. Come on, humanity, time to show some solidarity.
Been all over the world, but it doesn't matter where or wrong. Still catching wreck on the ass. How long will it last? Ain't no charity at home.
Sing it, they ain't playing.
Standing in the red, you see your lies. Too much going on not to see the signs.
Unify by Ra Goddess here on Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. Well, they're calling it a national security event as hundreds of thousands of people around the country prepare for the inauguration of George W. Bush. Law enforcement officials are also getting ready. The U.S. Secret Service says its agents will work with an army of local and federal law enforcement officers brought in from across the region. Secret Service agents have been checking manholes and staking out rooftops for their sharpshooters. U.S. Park Police are readying helicopters and horses. The FBI has put members of its swift response hostage rescue team on alert, and the Federal Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms is readying bomb-sniffing dogs. By January 20th, about 1,500 D.C. police officers will have taken a refresher course on crowd control. And information gathering is in full swing. D.C. police have been quietly infiltrating organizational groups and reportedly following organizers. Protesters say that police security measures, including blocking access to much of the inaugural area, is significantly infringing on First Amendment protected rights and will chill protest and even attendance at the inauguration. They're also charging that police are following a pattern begun in the demonstrations against the IMF and World Bank last April of issuing sensationalist warnings of violence despite insistence by the protest organizers that the protests will be peaceful and not aimed at shutting down the inauguration. We're joined by a number of people right now to talk about the preparations for the event, particularly looking at the police angle. We did try to get a representative from the Washington Police Department and were unable to get a representative. Mara Verheyden-Hilliard is with us, who is an attorney with Partnership for Civil Justice. Larry Holmes is with us in our New York studio from the International Action Center. And Liz Butler joins us from Coastal Rainforest Coalition. Mara Verheyden-Hilliard, what is the scene in Washington right now in terms of police preparations?
Well, the police are refusing to provide the public and demonstrators basic information that they're entitled to and that we've requested last week and that we expected to receive from them early this week about what exact actions the police expect to take, what kind of materials that they will allow and not allow, where they will allow people to go. And they've refused to provide this information, we believe, because they're attempting to disrupt folks' lawful organizing and attempting to disrupt lawful First Amendment-protected assembly. Throughout Washington, we've seen perimeter fencing go up. We have seen bleachers up and down Pennsylvania Avenue, which are going to be handed over only to persons who are approved by the Bush administration, who are given tickets and allowed to use those seats to view the parade. There's very limited space on Pennsylvania Avenue for the American public to view the parade or for demonstrators to express their points of view. The Park Service had up until recently refused to acknowledge that demonstrators had lawful permits to demonstrate along the parade route and occupy space along the parade route. But I think once they became aware that we would take them to court to force them to acknowledge those permits, they recently, in a reversal this week, acknowledged that there will be allowed to be permitted demonstrations at 14th and Pennsylvania Avenue and at 10th and Pennsylvania Avenue in front of the Justice Department as well as at McPherson Square.
Mara Verheiden Hilliard, you're also joined there at a news conference that's taking place at this hour by Liz Butler of the Coastal Rainforest Coalition. Liz, you've been arrested a number of times. What is your major point at the press conference today?
Well, a couple of points. One is that we've seen an increased activity of basically corporate controlled government, that the people of America and the folks who have concerns about issues are being shut out, and that really the intimidation factors that are being used by the police, they're really acting as the agents of the corporations that have been putting pressure on our government, really to answer to them. We're very concerned at the way the inauguration is being set up. There's a number of environmental groups who have a huge concern with the Bush administration, and yet we're being put in a situation where we have no way of expressing that concern. We have no way of expressing the concern of a good majority of Americans, because we're not going to be given the opportunity to get anywhere near the proceedings purely based on our political views and the fact that we don't give the kind of money to the politicians that the corporations do.
Liz Butler, on the issue of infiltration, what do you know at this point?
We've watched this pattern over the last year where the police are using intimidation tactics. They're acknowledging the fact that they are going undercover in organizations that are organizing around political views based solely on the fact that those views are not in line with President-elect Bush. Like, that's how they're picking who they're following around. They've acknowledged that they're coming to the Justice Action Movement meetings. They're acknowledging that they've been doing this for the last year. We saw this during April on the streets of D.C., where Chief Ramsey said that they had well over 1,000 undercover officers on the streets with the protesters. We saw them do preemptive strikes in both Washington, D.C., by shutting down our puppet-making and training center, by arresting 600 people who were not participating in any level in a civil disobedience act. And we've seen them repeat those tactics throughout the last year at the various protests, including the conventions. We think it's an effort to scare people away from the streets. We expect them to continue.
Well, I guess that is the question. Will this inhibit people from coming to protest in Washington? Larry Holmes, you're with the International Action Center. You've been arrested in Philadelphia at the Republican Convention in Washington at the IMF World Bank protests. Is this the message you think that the authorities are trying to send, like, watch out, perhaps don't come?
Of course they are. Let me just say hi, Mara, and hi, Liz. You know, while we're discussing the measures that the various police agencies are taking to prevent people from exercising their constitutional right to protest, let us remind ourselves that we do, in fact, have a right to go to Washington on January 20th. Thousands of people are going to Washington. There are permitted spaces for protests on Pennsylvania Avenue, which is along the route of the inaugural parade. You don't have to have a permit if you're going to assemble in numbers of 25 or less. You're supposed to have access to Pennsylvania Avenue. So let's be proactive and optimistic. And I think if a large number of us turn out, and there's lots of reasons for us to come, that fact alone helps us defeat and push back any conspiracy by the police to undermine the demonstration by taking draconian measures and by scaring us.
What is the major reason you're going to Washington, Larry Holmes?
Well, you know, initially, even before the elections, many of us felt we needed to be at the inauguration, regardless of whether it was Bush or Gore, because we wanted to fight against the death penalty. We wanted to draw the connection between that and the situation of our brother Mumia Abu-Jamal. We wanted to deal with other issues such as police brutality, the prison industrial complex. You know, this is coming up to be the 10th anniversary of the sanctions against Iraq. That's on January 15th. We wanted to raise Vieques and what the U.S. is doing in Colombia. And so we had plenty of reasons to do that. Now we have a bigger reason, because Bush stole the election. He stole the election by suppressing the African-American and Haitian vote in Florida and perhaps elsewhere. And that was rubber stamped by the most reactionary judges on the Supreme Court. And now people are angry about that. And I think that in some large measure, we're obliged to turn our protests into an opportunity for the people who are angry. I'm talking about everybody, but I'm thinking especially of African Americans. And there's a lot of African Americans in the District of Columbia. D.C. is about 80% black, to come down and express their feelings. And for those of us who are coming from around the country to be in solidarity with them. I think one act recently that gives us a lot of inspiration and shows us how important this issue is the Congressional Black Caucus actually getting up and walking out of a joint session of Congress that was there to give their rubber stamp on this stolen election. And I think that's going to make it easier for a lot of people to come on January 20th. And I think it's going to make it more difficult for the police to succeed in their conspiracy to prevent the protest.
Amara Verheyden-Hilliard, with Partnership for Civil Justice, do you expect civil disobedience? Let's see, the Executive Assistant Police Chief Terrence Gaynor said police have learned some protesters will try to wreak havoc on Inauguration Day. Quote, they've clearly indicated they want to come and disrupt the parade, and we're not going to let that happen.
Mr. Gaynor has made these kind of statements in the past, he's been proven wrong. He makes these kind of statements regularly in order to drum up sort of hostile views of the protesters. The violence that's ever been seen at these demonstrations is violence by the police. We expect this to be a peaceful and lawful demonstration. We expect the police to abide by the law. We expect demonstrators to abide by the law. Mr. Gaynor previously made claims that he had found Molotov cocktails at a convergence center last April, and in fact, all that he found was vegetables for the making of gazpacho soup, and later had to retract that. In fact, a producer of your show wrote an excellent article, Terry Allen, on the conduct of the police and the misinformation that they intentionally put out called, I believe it was called, Breaking the Law to Keep Order. But in general, these are the kind of statements that they make. They can't back them up, and we think that they should be given short shrift and disregarded. And I want to emphasize what Larry has said, which is that there are permits. It is lawful for people to come. We encourage everyone to come and express their views. They are entitled to. We all own Pennsylvania Avenue. George Bush and his incoming administration do not own Pennsylvania Avenue. They may not privatize the streets. Folks may come out and express their point of view. They may express their dissent. It's Washington, D.C., and it's what we do here. Now, the police certainly are trying to drum up their intimidation tactics, and they're making these, you know, absolutely unsupportable statements that they regularly make, and I think that folks should just disregard them, and they should come.
Are you concerned about this, what they're calling a national security event? How does that change the situation if it's not just the Washington police?
When they call this a national security event, it's actually, I believe, called a national special security event, and it allows all the law enforcement authorities to work under the supervision of the Secret Service, and they've designated this as such. Now, regardless of what they're claiming the security concerns are, they're mix and matching that with absolute First Amendment-protected verbal and you know, handheld signs of protest, and that is not a security concern. This is a completely pretextual claim at this point. And if they want to focus on security, focus on security. But they're putting an awful lot of effort into trying to disrupt demonstrators' lawful right to get along the parade route. And that has nothing to do with security, which shows that the security claims are pretextual.
Liz Butler, final question on why you're with the Coastal Rainforest Coalition going to be a protester on Inauguration Day.
Just like a number of folks, we were going to be out as the environmental community was going to be out regardless of the outcome of the election. We've been very concerned about pressures on our national forests and our public lands, as well as water and air issues. American public has repeatedly let their voice be heard to our government that they want stronger environmental protections. Now, recently, the increased corporate control of government has gotten to the point where the Washington Post called the Bush administration the new corporate White House. Bush has made statements that he wants to open up the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge for drilling. He's also made statements that he wants to reverse such things as the new policy to protect wilderness areas around the country. And also the chief of the Forest Service just finally said, after years of hearing from the public and from environmentalists, that we need to protect our old-growth forests in the U.S. And we're very concerned that that declaration is going to be moot in a matter of a month or two because the policies that Bush has of listening to the corporations and not to the people.
Go ahead.
You know, we want people out there on the streets.
If people want to get in touch with Coastal Rainforest Coalition, where can they call or go on the web?
We have a website. It's coastalrainforest.org. We also encourage people to check out the inaugural auction website, which is inauguralauction.org. It has a list of events that are happening on January 20th, a number of different groups that are involved in the protests and ways to both get involved, log in when they get here, and also participate in the various events that are happening and the various groups that are hosting them.
Larry Holmes, International Action Center.
People should be clear on some things. Mara and her colleagues in the Partnership for Civil Justice have, through their legal efforts, forced the various police authorities in Washington, D.C. to admit, to agree that there are permits along Pennsylvania Avenue for large demonstrations. The largest area for a permitted demonstration is at 14th Street in Pennsylvania at a place called Freedom Plaza, which can accommodate thousands of demonstrators. So we have the right to be there. You should come. You need to come on down.
And what's your contact information?
Obviously? Our contact information is 212-633-6646. If you get an opportunity to discuss some of the access problems either today or tomorrow pertaining to the demonstration, I think that would be important to get out to people. But there'll be more breaking news on that because it's not over.
And the website of the IAC.
The website is www.iaccenter.org.
And Mara Verheiden Hilliard, Partnership for Civil Justice.
One last thing I would like to say.
Just your contact information because we have to go.
You can reach the Partnership for Civil Justice at www.justiceonline.org, and our phone number is 202-530-5630.
Thank you very much. Mara Verheiden Hilliard, Larry Holmes, and Liz Butler. You're listening to Pacific Radio's Democracy Now! When we come back, we're going to take a look at why the media loves Rod Paige, who is the Education Secretary and designee. Stay with us. You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now!, the exception to the rulers. I'm Amy Goodman. The Senate appears to set to give easy approval to Education Secretary designee Rod Paige, as Paige won the support of both Republicans and Democrats on the Senate Health, Education, and Labor Committee. Both politicians and the media have overwhelmingly credited Paige for turning around Houston's public schools. Well, today we're going to take a look at how Paige succeeded in creating such a positive image. We're joined by Tim Fleck, who is a writer with the Houston Press, a New Times alternative weekly paper. Welcome to Democracy Now!, Tim.
Good morning, Amy.
So tell us a little about who Rod Paige is.
Well, Rod Paige is a very interesting character, and he literally emerged on the political scene here about a decade ago. And I wrote a long piece basically detailing his history, coming from the Texas Southern University, which at that time was a very troubled institution. He was the dean of education. He was also a longtime Republican activist. He was really set up to run for the school board in a pivotal position that could give a group of trustees who were supported by Houston business interests the majority in reforming and restructuring the district. He stepped in and ran in that race against 12 other candidates, and his campaign manager at that time was a Republican who later became the treasurer of the local party and then tax assessor, Paul Bettencourt. He won that race and then joined that majority on the board in voting to restructure the district. Restructuring meant breaking down the district and pushing privatization programs, subletting contracts, diminishing union control in the district. At that time, he was an unpaid trustee. He had started a private business called the Houston Education Collegium. He was elevated effectively by the votes of the other four trustees he had joined with and himself to become the superintendent without a nationwide search to replace Frank Petrozella. And from there, some people say he's been a brilliant spokesman for the restructuring of the district and emphasizing testing and educational reform. The two words that I hear from dissidents within the HISD bureaucracy are snake oil salesman and front man. And in a sense, he's carrying that role now on to the education secretaryship.
If he has so little background as an educator, how has he succeeded in creating such a positive media image?
I wouldn't say he has so little background as an educator. Definitely, you know, he was a dean at TSU. Before that, he was a physical education major, a football coach. But what he has been is a very effective kind of front that has made it very difficult for the traditional minority opponents to speak up, basically, to attack what the white majority was doing on the, or white minority was doing on the board. I had a quote from Don McAdams, who's one of that majority, who wrote a piece for the Brookings Institute several years ago called Lessons from Houston. And just briefly to quote a couple of paragraphs from it, "It is true that most of the reform leaders on the HISD board were white, but without Rod Paige, the board's voice would have been muted, and it would have been almost impossible for a white superintendent to implement Paige's New Beginnings agenda for HISD, which was also the agenda of the Greater Houston Partnership, a business group here which had campaigned for changes in the district. And to continue one more paragraph, only Paige could obtain support from a minority board and from minority leaders throughout the city for school choice, charter schools, contract placement of HISD students, the virtual elimination of board influence, and privatization. One could not play the race card against Paige." And in a sense, I think that's what he's going to function as for President Bush, is someone who can push charter schools, push voucher programs through Congress, and at the same time be immune to the sort of attacks Democrats might like to launch on the Bush programs.
Tim Fleck of the Houston Press, who is his press person, his public relations man.
Interesting character, Terry Abbott, former press secretary for an Alabama governor who was convicted of fraud for stealing, I think, his inaugural funds. He, when he came to town, he literally sort of drew in all the public relations functions to the point where it's very difficult to get a peep out of anyone in the district about Rod Paige or his programs without Terry first processing it. The word is he'll be going to Washington with Paige, so the D.C. press corps will get a look at him.
Tim Fleck is with the Houston Press. We're also joined by Arl Fitzsimmons, who is the Texas State Director of Service Employees International Union, leader of the Cafeteria Workers Union, and a parent of a fifth grader at Travis Elementary School. Can you talk about the issue of privatization under Rod Paige?
Well, Rod has actually came in and is acting like a CEO for some company that he just took over, and he's cut the maintenance department in the district. The buildings are in disrepair. He's cut the staff in the food service department, which is having now problems with serving the clientele, and participation rates are down with the children eating. And most importantly to the parents, being one myself, of a fifth grader, he's now instituting a program that encourages the food service department and a contractor for the department, Aramark, to feed children during class time. Breakfasts every morning because they won't eat them before school. And these are the free lunch children that have a free lunch, and they're basically force feeding every child in the free lunch program in the district, trying to up the numbers for Aramark because their program has not been very successful over the last 4 years.
Can you talk, if you can talk, Tim Fleck, about the piece you did, Days of Paige, Did Bush Pick a Master Educator and Overpaid Frontman, about how Paige rose to be Houston chancellor, how that led to a law passed by the Texas legislature?
Well, when Paige, as I mentioned earlier, joined the board, the trustees are unpaid, and he had his job at TSU, but I wouldn't call TSU a jumping-off point for a major superintendency in the United States. But after he was on the board a few years, he was voting with this reform minority. He was the swing vote. And then in a closed session, those trustees and Paige voted to elevate him to this highly paid superintendency without a national search. Hispanic activists were outraged because they felt that they didn't get consideration. The process was closed. In fact, the board member I quoted earlier, Don McAdams, bragged that we thought up this idea, we rammed it through in a closed session, everyone else was outraged. And as a result, legislators in the Texas legislature passed a law that from now on school board trustees have to be off the board at least a year before they can be elevated to highly paid executive positions within the district. The whole maneuver smacks of self-interest. You have a board member who joins and is voting with your block, and then your block elevates him to a highly paid superintendency. So that's what happened.
Arl Fitzsimmons, if you were one of the senators who was questioning Rod Paige in the confirmation hearing, you as a parent of a fifth grader, as a leader of the Cafeteria Workers Union, what question would you ask Rod Paige?
Well, there would be two. One is, why is it good public policy to take part of the school day and have a corporation come into the school and encourage the principal to give part of that instructional period when kids are supposed to be learning over to a private company to make profits? That would be my first question. The second one would be, why do you have a school district that you're in charge of getting $5.5 million from the Coca-Cola company and putting a Futopia machine in every school in the district, in a district that's predominantly Hispanic, which has a massive problem with diabetes in that community, and the Futopia machine has a drink in it that has 46 grams of sugar in every bottle they sell? So the question would be, why is it such a good idea for corporate America to be in these schools making a profit when the kids going to the schoolhouse in the morning. They should be there for an education, not a profit center for corporate America.
Well, based on how his hearing went before the Senate committee, before it goes to a full vote, it looks like you'll have a number of years to probably get in your question yourself for the next education secretary. Oral Fitzsimmons, thanks very much for being with us, State Director of the Service Employees International Union. And thank you very much to Tim Fleck, writer with the Houston Press. If people want to see your piece, Days of Page, where can they go on the web?
HoustonPress.com. Nothing easier.
Well, thanks for being
Thank you,
with
Amy.
Us. And as we talk about the various nominees of the Bush administration, we're going to now bring you one of the speeches that were given the day before yesterday around the issue of John Ashcroft, the Attorney General nominee of George W. Bush. As I said earlier in the program, Trent Lott, the Republican leader of the Senate, has said he has all 50 Republican votes behind John Ashcroft and has warned that Democratic efforts to derail the nomination could poison the effort to set a new cooperative tone on Capitol Hill. Meanwhile, some 200 civil rights, abortion rights, pro-gun control, and various other groups have formed a coalition to fight the former senator and Missouri governor's confirmation. This is a speech of Ralph Neese that he gave a few days ago at a news conference. Some of these groups announced that they will lead an all-out effort to defeat the nomination of John Ashcroft.
Good morning. My name is Ralph G. Neese. I am president of People for the American Way, a nonpartisan civil rights and civil liberties organization with 300,000 members nationwide. I wish that we did not have to be here today. This is only the fourth time in our history that we've opposed an executive branch nomination. George W. Bush has failed the nation with respect to this nomination. He couldn't have named someone more divisive and more confrontational. Yesterday, a reporter from one of the leading dailies asked me, "Ralph, is this really such a big deal?" Yeah, it really is. As someone who served as a chief counsel to two Republican senators during the 1970s, as someone who served as the director of the Leadership Conference on Civil Rights for 15 years, this is the worst executive branch nomination I have ever seen. The position of Attorney General is special. It's the lawyer for all the people, not just the president. Should have the highest qualifications, a demonstrated commitment to equal justice under the law, but the person should also have the right temperament, be a person of integrity, be a person of tolerance. John Ashcroft's record is exactly the opposite. It's a public record of indifference, if not hostility, to equal opportunity for all Americans. It's an extreme record with respect to the critical issues that the Attorney General has responsibility for. How extreme is John Ashcroft? The National Journal, in 1999, looking at the 105th Congress, said, the most conservative, tied for the most conservative, to the right, I might add, of Senator Jesse Helms. Perfect scores with the Christian Coalition and the National Right to Life Committee. And just yesterday, I found out that the John Birch Society rates John Ashcroft, their number two senator, ahead of Jesse Helms, a little behind Bob Smith. Who would have thought at the beginning of the millennium that a president-elect would name or would nominate to be Attorney General someone to the right of Senator Jesse Helms? I want to emphasize, we're not talking about policy disagreements primarily. We're talking about a record so far to the right of the Republican Party, way to the right. This is a record. If you look at abortion, it's not just a debate over abortion. It's with respect to banning abortions, including those who are victims of rape and incest, or a human life amendment that would also ban contraceptives like the birth control pill and IUD. 90-95% of Americans oppose that kind of a policy. People don't know yet that he vetoed a domestic violence funding act for battered women and children in Missouri, or that he vetoed the rape shield law that would protect victims of rape from being made public in the newspapers. racial insensitivity. We want to make clear we do not contend that John Ashcroft is a racist. What we contend is in a record of extraordinary indifference and hostility. Look at the Bob Jones example. Going to Bob Jones in May of 1999, a school that discriminates on the basis of race and has a history of calling religions like Mormonism and Catholicism cults. George W. Bush apologized for going to Bob Jones. John Ashcroft sent a Christmas card saying it was one of the highlights of his year. Southern Partisan Magazine, a magazine that has defended those who were slaveholders, giving the slaveholder perspective on our history. And its fundraising arm raises money by putting out T-shirts that celebrate the assassination of Abraham Lincoln. This is not sensitivity. This is extraordinary insensitivity. Ronnie White, I don't see this primarily as a racial issue. It is an integrity issue. John Ashcroft misled the United States Senate. He mischaracterized the record of a distinguished African-American jurist. The Ronnie White episode alone disqualifies John Ashcroft to be Attorney General of the United States. John Ashcroft is well qualified to be head of the Christian Coalition. He is well qualified to be head of the National Rifle Association. He is not qualified to be Attorney General of the United States. George W. Bush, if you are remotely sincere about being bipartisan, reaching out to all Americans, if you are sincere about being uniter, withdraw this nomination today. Thank you very much.
Ralph Neese, head of People for the American Way. Ralph Neese was one of those who spearheaded the opposition to the Robert Bork nomination to be Supreme Court Justice. You are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! When we come back, we go to Israel and the occupied territories for the latest news there. Stay with us. You are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. The widow of a Palestinian official gunned down by Israeli troops in the West Bank asked the Israeli Supreme Court this week to order caretaker Prime Minister Ehud Barak to halt the army's policy of assassinating suspected Palestinian fighters. Thabet's appeal comes during an intensified shooting war between Israelis and Palestinians and renewed negotiations to find a resolution. Security officials from both sides met in Cairo on Sunday with CIA Director George Tenet. More meetings are expected soon. Siham Thabet argues in her petition that if the army had evidence against her husband, Thabet, it could have arrested him. The assassinated 40-year-old activist was an outspoken advocate for peace and negotiation and among the first Palestinians to dare to reach out to Israelis during the late 1980s. The shock of his death, delivered by long-range automatic weapons fire outside his home in broad daylight, has sparked protests. In her petition, Thabet asks that the executions without trial, taking lives as the result of an operational initiated action and not in the course of war or military action, should be declared illegal. If the Supreme Court accepts the petition, the army could be forced to explain its policy in court. Thabet's assassination is not an isolated incident, but rather a coordinated high-tech campaign justified by Israel as part of the war. According to the Los Angeles Times, Barak, Deputy Defense Minister Ephraim Sneh, and various Army spokesmen have said that the Army hunts down those who attack Israelis and the ones who send them, and that it will kill them when they can be found. Estimates of those killed by political assassination range from 13 to 31. According to Time magazine, Israel's security service, Shin Bet, has a list of names of about 100 potential targets in the West Bank and Gaza Strip, and it has the Army's finest marksmen to call upon when it decides to strike. We're joined right now by Naila Atiya, who is an Israeli lawyer from Haifa, who now is living in Ramallah. And she was hired by Thabet's widow to file the petition with the Israeli Supreme Court challenging the political assassination of her husband. We welcome you to Democracy Now! Welcome to Democracy Now!, Naila Atiya.
Yeah, I am here.
Can you explain the petition that you just filed?
I try to help... to stop the killing innocent people in Palestinian innocent people here in the occupation territories in Gaza and the West Bank. I need that the High Court to take a decision that the killing without charge it is illegal because it is against of the law of the Israel law. And against also Geneva Convention, which Israel have must expected and expect the life of the human being, which are innocent, and she must not killing him them without trail. Israel can arrest everybody, everywhere, whatever he was. She did that during all the years, all the last years, when she wants somebody that she thinks that he do something against Israel and give him, bring him to Israel and take him to the prison and arrest him. And if Israel find evidence, she can take him to the court and trial him. But here we have a new situation. The situation is it that Israel market very Palestinian people that Israel believe that they against his political political because that she kill him without any without any evidence, without any any checkup, without anything.
Well, let me
only
ask.
Thinking that he against Israel send the soldiers and they kill him.
And Israel does not deny, the state doesn't deny that it does this, that engages in these assassinations.
Sorry,
does the state, does Israel deny it engages in these assassinations? Does Israel admit that it engages in these assassinations? Does the Israeli state?
Israel, no, don't say no until now. That Israel don't kill the Dr. Thabet or else. I mean the 30-31 Palestinian people. Which was killing through this last two months. Israel don't think anything. On the answer was we will continue the assassination. We will continue make whatever we can make to against these people which not accept our line in Israel. Policy, because that I think that the High Court cannot say okay to this political, to this killing without without trail innocent people. Because that I think that the High Court will give us the order to stop this killing and to decide if Israel needs somebody, they can arrest him. Especially, I want to see only last thing, that there is a little area, 10% of the east, the West Bank and the Gaza, which the Palestinian already under their control. Israel, no, Israel all the time have the security control, and Israel all the time can whatever they want, they can come to the home for everybody like David. They arrived him with the guns. They cannot arrest him. They was at the next door. They was very close to them. There was no military power there, and there was not a military accident there. They only was Dr. Tabet, without any guns, without anything, go to his work in his car, and they arrived to him and killing him. They were in six big bullets.
Huh.
500. And M16. Six bullets in his heart, in his chest.
Nela Tia,
you know,
is
they don't let the doctor at the next door come and help him. The doctor, Dr. Sergali, which living at the next door, he want to help him. When he listens the shooting outside, he come outside to help him, and they shoot him three bullets.
And
but he don't not was not not touch him or not dead.
Nela Atiyah, I want to bring a second guest into the conversation. Nela Atiyah, again, is an Israeli lawyer from Haifa who is now living in the West Bank in Ramallah, and she is the attorney who has filed a petition with the Israeli Supreme Court challenging the political assassination of Tabet. She brought this on behalf of Tabet's widow. We're also joined on the phone by Marwan Dalal, who is a staff attorney of Adela, the Legal Center for Arab Minority Rights in Israel. Now, there was a very interesting report that's come out in the last week. In the West Bank and Gaza, recent days have seen a notable increase in Palestinians wounded or killed as they go about their daily business. Since the start of the new year, at least five people have been killed by gunfire in or near their homes or on the way to their jobs. Throughout the wave of violence, which began in late September and has claimed hundreds of lives, the vast majority of them Palestinian, bystanders have occasionally found themselves in the wrong place at the wrong time. But human rights groups and Palestinians say for the first time, such casualties appear to be overtaking those among Palestinians taking part in stone throwing. We're joined by Marwan Dalal to talk about this issue of violence. Welcome to Democracy Now!
Hi, good morning.
Yes. Is this Marwan Dalal?
Yes, this is Marwan Dalal speaking.
Good to have you with us. Talk about this shift in the violence.
Yes, well, I think we're witnessing a new level of evil and the banality of the occupation, of the Israeli occupation. If in the first intifada, the Israeli soldiers were in the Palestinian towns and trying to arrest physically and beating Palestinian demonstrators, now, since they're not inside the towns, they're trying to contain the Palestinian popular revolt through shooting by snipers. They think, in the Israeli militaristic mentality, they think that this is an efficient way to control the Palestinian revolt. On one hand, there's no Israeli casualties. On the other, severe casualties on the Palestinian side. I think that although the Palestinians have given so much sacrifices, and although they're the underdog in this continuous resistance to the Israeli occupation, this lethal use of force will not deter, in my opinion, the continuation of the Palestinian popular revolt.
Do you think the petition that Nela Atiya has brought, the Israeli attorney, is going to affect, would, if these political assassinations, if the court said they had to stop, would it affect the overall level of violence?
Well, the Israeli High Court had a long record of not challenging the policies of the government, the militaristic policies of the Israeli government. For a long time, the Israeli High Court legitimized the torture policy of the Israeli intelligence. 2 years ago, it decided, it chose to change its mind, and it abolished this policy. Nevertheless, we still witness cases of torture. Now, in my opinion, the Israeli High Court is still chooses not to challenge, especially in what Israel regards as an emergency situation. In these cases, the High Court tends to join the consensus, the existing Israeli consensus, as if Israel is being under attack, although it's the strongest might in the Middle East. So I don't think that it's going to affect the military policy of the Israeli occupation in any way.
We're also joined on the telephone by Ziad Abu Ayn, who is with Nela Atiya. You are with Fatah, founded by Yasser Arafat. Your group has very much been targeted by the Israeli state. What has that meant?
You know, Israel is right now trying to killing the Intifada, to stop the Intifada. The Intifada, this is the willing of the people to change their life, because the Palestinian people want to stop the occupation. They have the full willing to live with the Israeli state, but not willing to live with the Israeli occupation, with the Israeli settlement. We are part of the peace process. We signed the peace process. We were defending the Israeli security more than 7 years during from Oslo to right now. But right now, the people want to stop the occupation. Daily, the Israeli have settlements. Daily, the Israeli is killing people. Daily, innocent people. Daily, we have a problem with the Israeli. They don't want to solve the political problem, and they're trying to solve this political problem by using military to solve this.
Why do you think the Israeli government has targeted Fatah in particular?
Fatah, right now, movement, they are the head of this intifada. They are calling for peace. They are defending the people well. They are defending their holy places. And for that, because Fatah is the leader of the people, the leader of the biggest political party between the Palestinian people, right now the Israeli is trying to killing some leader of Fatah factions.
And what has it meant for the organization?
More than 20 from Fatah movement right now be assassinated by Israel. And we have more than 340 Palestinians being killed during this intifada, and more than 14,000 Palestinians being injured by the Israeli troops.
Finally, we only have 30 seconds, but very quickly, to Marwan Dalal, what does it mean that Ariel Sharon has formally kicked off his presidential campaign?
Yes, Mr. Sharon, right now, who's the massacre in Beirut, making the massacre Sabra and Shatir in Beirut, right now he's going to be the prime minister of Israel, and he's making plans. He wants to stop the peace process between the Palestinian and the Israeli, and he said, okay, the peace is to don't enter Nablus again. Not the peace that to give us what the international law gave us, 242338, to respect it.
On that note, we have to wrap up. Of course, we'll continue to follow the story. Marwan Dalal, Nela Atiya, and Ziad Abu Ayn, I want to thank you for being with us. Democracy Now! Produced by Terry Allen, Chris Abrams, Anthony Sloan, our engineer from the embattled studios of WBAI. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for listening.
I'm Mark Cooper, contributing editor of The Nation magazine.